Hey y'all, and welcome to another episode of That Vet Life. Today on the podcast, I am very excited to welcome Dr. Dave Nickel to the microphone. The creator of VetX and author of The Yellow Pages Are Dead and So You're a Vet, Now What? Dr. Nickel has created a space for vet students and recent grads to find their footing and reach their potential within the veterinary profession. In today's episode, Dr. Dave shares his experiences of being a vet student at Glasgow Veterinary School and learns that the rivalry between Edinburgh and Glasgow is still as alive as it ever was. Additionally, we look at the bigger questions about how do we face the expectations and realities of the veterinary profession, and how do we, as up-and-coming professionals, respond to the attrition rates that we're now faced with? All right, to answer all these questions and more, let's roll that intro. So, welcome to the show.
Hello. Nice to be here.
So I feel like we kind of need to address the elephant in the room that's more in the theoretical space here. You are, if I can remember correctly, a Glasgow grad.
You did that very well without hissing at me, which you probably need to some way qualify. I mean, not as a vet, just as a general statement of why that would be pertinent at all.
The reason kind of picking on Glasgow grad, as you know, I am in Edinburgh Vet School, and there's a little bit of a rivalry we'll go with. We'll just use a bit of
needle, shall we say. competitive needle.
To the point, it's not necessarily in the academics of vet school, but certainly in the athletics. To the point where we actually have a day, it's coming up next week actually, where both schools, they go head to head in every single sport event that is even possible. The thing is, you realize you kind of know who the winner generally is by the name.
I think you really need to tell them what the name is then. Are you going to say it or am I? I think you should say it. You should have the honor.
Okay, so the name of this sporting day is called Dick Day. And before you go on a rant or something, I want to clarify, this is the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, named after William Dick. Just putting that out there. Okay, get it out. It's not like you haven't had that many years to laugh about it already.
Okay, so let's move past the name, because we could get stuck there and puerile giggle moment for literally the whole hour. Dick Day actually holds some of my fondest memories. Let's say very hazy memories, I have to say.
Oh wait, so they had Dick Day back in your day?
How rude! Yes, they certainly did, and a long time before. But it's one of those magical traditions. Scotland has lots of tradition, some of it good, some of it not very good, and this is one of those traditions that I think is really a wonderful rivalry. My Dick Day story, see, I can't even say it without snickering, my Dick Day story goes back to, I went to university in 1993, and I played rugby to a reasonably senior level, And so I was drafted into the team as scrum half, and had very long hair and was the smallest guy on the pitch. And I really wasn't prepared for the level of vitriol that was going to be inflicted by each team on the other. It was absolutely a grudge match. And of course, we went out on the pitch and we did what Glasgow normally do, which is get absolutely hammered on the field athletically. And then we got absolutely hammered with alcohol off the field afterwards. But it was the combativeness, the energy of the crowd, the excitedness, it really, I suppose, is akin to what, again, I guess a college sports match might be, except played in virtual darkness under an overcast and usually raining, windswept. Was at Peffermill in my day, or Westerlands in Glasgow, or Garscube in Glasgow as it is now, and we would routinely get flogged. Now the fun bit not fun for me, but we actually won it in my second year. And the pitches were so frozen in the fourth year, you guys sort of forfeited by not showing up because we were on the pitch and so we did play. So I claim by default we sort of won it, but that doesn't count because we didn't get to actually play a game of rugby. But in second year, we did win it, but about 2 days before the match, I developed acute appendicitis and was pulled into hospital and had surgery, I think on the day that the game happened, and the game was won with a kick from about the halfway line by the wonderful Ed Bullman in the last second of the game to absolute uproar, because it's one of those unicorn moments in Glasgow history. So there you go. So that's my dictate story.
I don't think I have anything quite as glamorous for that, other than my very first day for this. It was my first year, and it got rained out. Like, we were supposed to be in Glasgow. So every other year, for people who don't know, it's either at Glasgow, and then the next year it's at Edinburgh. So this year it is at Glasgow. And my first year, it was supposed to be at Glasgow as well. So a number of the sports teams went already. They were in Glasgow. Our team were gathering in the atrium of the vet school, getting ready to get on the coaches. And there was like this hellfire frenzy happening in the administration of Dictay. And they're like, we can't find a pitch for you guys. Everything is waterlogged. And we're all standing, like, the guys' teams, the girls' team, because I played in the girls' rugby team. And we just, they could not find a pitch for us. Like, it just wasn't happening. So we stood there forever. And then finally they're like, sorry, guys, we're not going to be able to play. And I was like, this is my first year.
Oh, you'd be so psyched and pumped for it as well, Hick.
I was so excited, so ready for it. But it was okay, because last year it came to Edinburgh and we absolutely demolished you guys. I still reference you as a Ouija, so...
How absolutely terribly rude. Now, I have to say, I'll add in there that our women's rugby team were absolutely phenomenal whilst I was there and crushed everyone before them. And I coached the Glasgow University women's rugby team in 1998. And it was largely composed, certainly over 50% were from the vet school team, plus then the other, you know, the additions from the other faculties, and we won promotion into the, I'm not sure if it was the top flight, but we certainly won promotion up into the next league, which was phenomenal. And the team won the BUSA, you know, the British Universities Cup or Shield the year before that. So luckily in my day, I could live vicariously through the absolutely sterling and wonderful efforts of the girls, who I have to say were the favourite coaching role I ever had. They were just magnificent, and did such a good job. It was an absolute pleasure doing that. That was the start of my leadership journey, I think.
All right. Yeah, it's a good place to start. I mean, actually, I think rugby and vet school, they perfectly mirror each other.
It's contact sports all the way.
Pretty much.
100%. And by the way, and none of this wear pads, run and sprint for like 7 seconds before all falling over with people throwing tea cloths at each other, which is what NFL looks like.
Mm-hmm. It actually is pretty funny, because even last night we were going to practice and there's an American football team like practicing. And actually some of our girls who had like never really seen American football, they're like, why do they wear all these shoulder pads and these helmets? And I kind of had to explain it, that it's just, the way they hit isn't exactly maybe safe, and so they have to really protect themselves. But they're actually starting to implement rugby-style tackling into American football to try and reduce the number of concussions.
Yeah, the concussion thing's big, so. Hey. Well, look, I actually think that is all one massive, feeble excuse for their just epic lightweights and not real, you know, athletes. You know, bring them over and let's play rugby and let's thrash that one out. So I've got a very dear American friend, Bill, coming over for London Vet Show, which is coming up in November. And I am taking him, I've a sort of surprise trip. It won't be a surprise now because I've just podcast, but I bought tickets to go to the Scotland South Africa game, which will be a blood and thunder affair, as any match against South Africa always is. So I'll be bringing him up to the city of your current residence, which I will admit, Edinburgh is actually a city I actually do thoroughly enjoy, love visiting, and is also a much more fun night out when the Rugby Internationals are on. for that night only. So I'm going to be bringing my good friend Bill Schroeder up to that match and showing him what real sport looks like. And then he can make up his own mind. So, but I mean, the jury's not out. I mean, rugby is rugby. It's the best.
Rugby is rugby. I do love rugby. But kind of just going back to it, so being in Glasgow then, you say you have fond memories of being like in the vet school and like working with the rugby teams, but like actually being in vet school, what kind of memories do you have from there? Or is it just a big blur?
Yes. Listen, I'm 42 now, and everything was a big blur from, I think, really the point of graduation, and it's only getting more and more blurry as time goes on. And I don't think that's senility yet. I think that's just the speed of life and stuff as you fill your life with purpose and meaning and things, then, you know, there seems to be less and less time available, and it just speeds super fast. But turning back to university, I mean, the first thing was excitement that I had achieved this lifelong goal of getting to vet school. So that was the first thing on the horizon. It was like, I was, you know, that was beyond that. I'm not really sure I had much of a plan beyond that, which was, you know, I'll be a vet. So that almost got set to one side to say, well, look, how'd you do that? Well, I've got to get to vet school. So that became the objective. And then hadn't really thought through how the hell I was going to get out the other side of vet school. That was just something that we would have to work on. And so arrived to this, you know, crazy school where, you know, say Glasgow was a drinking school with a veterinary medicine problem in some ways. And I do use that, and I shouldn't, because I don't want to glorify alcohol terribly or unnecessarily. But what I mean by that, it was a very social school, and I will always be extremely grateful for that, because I had offers from Edinburgh and Glasgow. Of course, I would have been disowned by my entire family unit had I accepted the offer at Edinburgh. But it was a great school for me to go to, because it was so social. Of course, there was a strong academic element, and maybe my second memory was thinking, "Oh dear, what have I done? I don't belong," and really feeling like I was not smart enough to be here. Now, I was never top of my school. You know, I was smart enough to get to vet school, but I was never academically top of the class at school. And that, so vet school, you're at vet school, when you go, you're going to slip further down your position in the academic class, more than likely. And for most people, that's going to be, you know, a lot of people going to vet school were top of their class and top of their year or ducks of their year. And you're just not going to be at vet school. There's one person will, and only one. So everybody else is going to slip down the rankings. In my case, I quite cheerfully propped up the class in that bottom 25%. But I spent a long while in the academic subjects thinking, how on earth am I going to get through this? I mean, A, how am I even going to maintain my interest level in it? Because a lot of the subjects I didn't have a lot of interest in. I didn't really come from a farming background, though I lived in the country. And farming systems, I was looking at things thinking, oh God, you know, this really doesn't float my boat. I liked going out in farm calls and visiting farms, but I liked it because I was interacting with the farmers. I did not like standing on the side of, you know, windswept hills just outside of St. Andrews in the middle of February, and it's 4 in the afternoon and it's pitch black and your hands are freezing and you're just getting kicked senseless like that. The joy was getting the hell back in a car and switching your heaters on. The work wasn't that exciting to me. So I spent a long while feeling a little bit like a fish out of water at university. And when I say a long while, I kind of mean the best part of 4 years. And what kept me really engaged was the sporting side of university. I was very active playing rugby for various clubs, the university ones and some of the clubs around Glasgow. And I was always, you know, I was at an active mind thinking about other things. Music was a big deal to me. So I was, you know, I was able to maintain my connection and sense of worth through being year club I was year club president in the first year. I was hall president at Wolfson Hall in the second year. Third year, I played rugby fairly seriously for the university, which resulted in my favourite ever grade in parasitology, which was a fat 29%.
Oh boy!
which invited me a little trip to the parasitology professor's office and for a bit of a chat, and then I had to start learning about lots of different stages of parasite growth, which nearly broke me, to be perfectly honest. It was so dull. And then in fourth year, I organized the vet review, and I was still playing a little bit of rugby at that point. And then fifth year, I again played fairly seriously, but I organized all the Fridays or for sport weekend in the vet school. And again, was just always active in the social side, the community side of being at university, and thoroughly enjoyed that side of it. And I had a really great group of friends, as you all do at vet school as well. And those friends we call each other a band of brothers, and it'd be a band of sisters as well. And, you know, you'll be bonded and connected to those people for forever. You've been through an experience that nobody else will go through. And nobody else will understand through vet school, and that will bond you forever to these people. So, you know, definitely keep in touch with those people. So it was really that social side kept me connected. And then there was a moment in fifth year when we were in Glasgow at the time. It was one of the first vet schools to have an all practical final year. Which was just great because we could put down the rote learning and learning for exams, and now it got real. And I absolutely crystal clarity remember the moment where things switched on, and I had an epiphany in my final year at vet school. I was at the PDSA, so the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals, is UK charity that is really not shelter medicine, but, you know, it's a charitable organisation, cares for low income families with their pets. And Glasgow had an association with them such that they would allow the final years into the consultation rooms and to start doing consultations with clients for real. And I had a group of three, and so we went in the room as a two, and then we swapped, and then we'd get chance as a one. And I remember being in that room. First up, I didn't go first, but I listened to one of my colleagues going first. And in that moment, I instantly started thinking, well, I wouldn't have said that, or I would have said that a little differently. I might ask this question. And suddenly it all changed, all flipped around. And from being somebody who really was hanging on throughout the class by his fingernails, to suddenly thinking, you know what, I actually think this is what I could be the best person, be the best in the class at, was being in that exam room with the clients, because I could find rapport very easily with them, and it was just natural. It was almost like a mini performance, a mini stage that you could be on, you could be yourself, and it as it turned out, the clients quite liked that self, because I was, you know, as you might already have gathered, I'm quite an informal person. I am quite extroverted, and I like to have fun, and people find that disarming in an alien space, which is what a veterinary practice is. You go in and you're expecting a doctor to be kind of aloof, or, you know, up on a pedestal, or full of ego, or talking in words you don't understand, and they just get basically the Scottish goofball in me, and suddenly it wasn't so scary. And so clients would say things, or you know, give me information, or say yes to recommendations, where people would be like, well, how did they do that? What happened? And I wasn't really able to answer the question, but what I was able to say was, in that moment, I thought, yes, this is a career I would love to do for the rest of my life, and I will be happy doing that. And I hadn't had that feeling for the first 4 years in college. So those are my sort of memories, you know, of hard work, of gutting it out sometimes, of being in the community, of building amazing friendships that will last a lifetime, and of finally finding my home after quite a long road of feeling like maybe this wasn't a great decision. So they're my memories.
Yeah, I think that they certainly resonate with a lot of students nowadays, just kind of feeling a little bit lost in their years of vet school. But I think you kind of hit on something that is very, very pertinent right now, in that many students, they maybe don't realize it when they're first getting into vet school, but like veterinary medicine is maybe 25% animals and 75% people. And I think the sooner that people kind of realize that, it kind of grants them a little bit of understanding and helps them figure out where they're going in veterinary medicine. Because if you go into veterinary medicine thinking that, oh, I'm just going to be fixing animals and I don't have to deal with people, then you're just not finding your fulfillment, because like you need to work with people. Like being a human being, you have the innate need of working with and being with other people. But just like figuring it out when you're in vet school is really, really hard, because you're like, you focus on the animals and you focus on the animals. And actually, it's interesting. It's not really until you get into farm animal medicine that they're almost teaching you how to work with your client. In smallies, it's like, here is the clinical signs, here's the disease. But when you get into farm animal, that's where they're like, so you need to sit down and talk with your client. How are you going to talk with them about this? And we're doing that in our lectures, not just in our tutorials. But I'm getting myself a little bit off topic. But
that's a great topic.
But yeah, just going back to how like it's a job with animals, but the majority of it is with people. And this kind of ties into the whole point of why we're kind of talking today is back in, I believe it was September, end of September, you had one of your Instagram stories where you popped your little Q-tips into your ears and you were chatting with people on Instagram. And for people who don't understand, it's the Apple headphones that look like Q-tips in your ears.
They're yeah. like cigarette butts in my ears. I regularly cop abuse for that.
Yeah, but you were just kind of having a little chat with people, a one-sided chat to a degree, with other than what was coming through the Instagram. Here, I'm going to have a conversation with you, but it's just my thoughts. And it was, you call it your Friday night rant, and you were just kind of talking about people. The gist of it I got anyway was the people having a difference in the realities over expectations. Of going into vet school and coming out, because we're seeing, I don't know, are we seeing a lot more of dissonance with like people just being unhappy with the job because they're not the right people for the job, or is it this cultural influence? And you kind of just started to dive into that a little bit more, so I'll let you kind of bring that back up to the surface.
Bubbling up like some bilious thing that it is. So let me preface what I'm going to say with a couple of things. First thing is that in some ways I suspect there is a lot that is the same about the job now as it has always been. You know, the animals are the same. The hours have changed dramatically, actually. They've improved really beyond measure in a very short space of time. You know, the nature of the work, the client expectations. I do not feel like client expectations have changed dramatically in the last decade.
Now, see, I've actually, not to just jump in too much, but I've actually heard otherwise from different veterinarians. They're like, they're expecting a lot more of us because of the money and all these things.
Yeah, I strongly disagree with that, because I have always worked with clients who expected more. Or maybe I've always been of my head that I have always tried to out-deliver what a client wants. And to that extent, perhaps I'm in a bubble, because I've always been good at trying to give clients a good experience. And that reflects where I've worked, because I've worked in some of the least economically, the most impoverished places in the UK, being in the northeast of England, in some, you know, in a fairly dodgy borough in southeast London, and had clients who did not have a lot of money, yet have always had branch practices that have performed above the expected level and significantly above that. And that has happened because it's never about money, it's always about value. And so if you can deliver a service or an experience where people are getting great value, they just think, wow, I've not had that value someplace else, or I understand why that thing needs to happen, then things get better. I would challenge anybody that says client expectations have dramatically increased to provide me with evidence to that beyond the anecdote, because pet owners have always cared about their animals being safe under anesthesia. Pet owners have always cared that you get answers for them. Pet owners have always cared that you see them on time. None of those things have changed one little jot. It's not like we went from the age of animals being in the backyard or cats being there to keep the mouse numbers down or dogs for protection into the, you know, that transition happened 20 years ago. You know, it's 20 years ago that I graduated and referral practice was going great. Expensive first opinion practice, general practice was going great and was a thing. I really don't think that has changed. I think perhaps what's happened is there's a shift in the expectations of the next generation of vets that are coming through. So the job hasn't changed. I don't believe clients' expectations have changed. The technology has certainly changed a bit, but largely we're still using ultrasound, x-rays. Increasingly we have access to CT and MRI, but again, that's not really mainstream. So I don't think that side of technology has changed much. I think one of the things that has changed, there's two really huge changes for me in the marketplace. And one, there's a generational difference. You know, the generation that's coming through now has different needs, desires, wants, values, attitudes to the world around them than had my generation, just as Gen X had different to boomers, and boomers had different to the forgotten generation or the builders. That's generational shift, and we're in that period at present. What else has changed? Corporate, you know, ownership structures within practices are changing dramatically. We have a glut of private equity money flying around and sloshing around the veterinary sector at the minute, and it's happening in Australia, it's happening in the United Kingdom, it's happening in America. It will not continue forever, but it's there. And so our ownership structures have changed. And when with that, the access to mentoring, the increasingly regimented and not rote style medicine, but the core focus on what vets should be doing and what we should refer, it has changed. The mentoring thing, I think, is one of the big things, though, because, you know, for young vets now, if you're going to take on a surgery, that involves an element of risk. And I think generationally, in some ways, we have, you know, millennials seem less willing to put themselves into a situation of discomfort, which is what risk is, really. Less willing to work the level of hours. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. In fact, I think it's probably a smart thing for this generation to think that. But less willing to put in the work, a greater expectation that they are the done job when they get to the start line, and a struggle with resilience, which I think is a lot to do with, as a society, how we now raise our children. So that's a product of parenting as much as anything. But when you've got that attitude to risk, a struggle with resilience, you're now in a tough spot if you're going to really push the boundaries on learning your craft. Because where are the mentors? Like, in order to get good at something, you have to try. And when you try something, when you start out, guess what? You're going to fail because you blow chunks at it. And that's just completely normal. But instead of us having this normal learning pathway where now we go, okay, well, you failed, so great, well done. Try again. Now we've created a term for it called imposter syndrome, which it isn't. That's just the transition from being unconsciously incompetent to being consciously incompetent, and we're calling that imposter syndrome, and we need to stop doing that. I've started calling it your imposter monkey, because you put the word monkey with any other words and it becomes funny and a bit lighter. But it's not a syndrome, it's just a natural part of the learning pathway. And in order to get to consciously competent, which is the next stage, you have to keep trying. Now, if you fail and you get a bruise, then the last thing you want to do is fall off the horse and get bruised again, right? So what you need is a good instructor to tell you and guide you on what way to sit on the horse, which rein to pull on, how to approach, how to position your body as you approach the jump so you don't fall off again. Maybe drop the size of the jump down so it's not so terrifying, and guide you. And I think that's one of the effects that corporatization is having, is we're struggling with mentors. You know, we've got a generation of vets that are selling practices for very good money, and no blame on them. It is ridiculous money. So, you know, of course they're going to do that. And they're staying on for 1 to 2 years, and then what? You know, then they don't have an interest in developing that next generation, and they're burned out as well, because frankly they've all worked far too long hours and at the end of their tether with what they're doing, and so they're exiting, and they're exiting earlier, and they're exiting without the same regard for building up the next generation who would have been partners in their practice, recruited to be partners and then built up to be the next generation of leaders. And so my theory is that actually this generation are struggling somewhat because of the way we've brought them up as a society, and somewhat because of the system we're now putting them into. But perhaps there's a third reason in there as well, and I think our smartphones are a big part of that. And now we are so distracted, we are so unable to focus. There's a huge challenge for this generation and generations beyond in being able to achieve skills where you have to work hard to get good at something. And broadcasting that message to a generation that has become completely hooked on the Insta feedback that goes with social media, the Insta gratification. There is no delayed gratification anymore. Timelines from start to finish of anything that brings you a feel-good factor has reduced because of technology. And unfortunately, it doesn't work that way with skills. Skill acquisition is a slow, linear, laborious, repetitive process.
Yeah, you need to learn how to eat dirt for a while before you actually get anywhere.
That's exactly what it is. But we've got a generation that is extremely unwilling and almost allergic to the taste of dirt. And that attitude has to change. And it is just an attitude. It can change. And I've coached many, many young vets. And if you have the attitude of growth, if you're able to set aside your ego and say, well, actually, it's okay to fail. It's almost like as business owners and leaders now, we are having to parent this generation in a way that I did not require parenting. And that is a message I'm hearing over and over and over again from practice owners all around the world when I speak to them. We have had very little hardship in our lives growing up over the last 20 or 30 years, longer even. There's been no wars. No generations have been sent into conflict and have faced down Hitler's bullets. We have had, and when I say no wars, I mean no wars where we were drafted, and world wars. Of course, there's conflict around the world. No disrespect to the service people that serve and lay their lives on the line every day. But for the most of us, we've lived a very comfortable life, and with very little hardship, with an abundance, with economies that, even though we had a recession not so long ago, it still didn't mean for most of us that we couldn't put food in our plate. It wasn't a depression. You know, if you go back to the builder generation, they faced down Hitler's bullets and they had a depression to deal with. The boomers grew. The excess of the boomers, the materialism of the boomers came because they didn't have those things. But they built a whole economy and built what we're still benefiting on from today. And then us, the Gen Xers, or me, the Gen X generation, came along and so we still had a work ethic. We still worked. But I think each generation, we weren't so materialistic at all. And now we get into the millennials where as parents, we started to want the best for our kids, and in doing that we provided the best, and everything's been on a silver platter there ready. Layer on the instant gratification of social media, and you've got a generation that expects it now. But you've got the other side of the social media is the fear, right? The fear of failure, because when I took on a risky thing and I screwed up, I had the support of my boss, who was probably mentoring me. If it went wrong and a client complained, it was between me, the client, the animal, of course, my boss, and if I was very unlucky, the local newspaper. And you would have had to be really unlucky for that to happen, right? Fortunately, it never did to me. Now, hell, young vets now, they're doing this game, learning their craft without mentors, in front of a backdrop of millions who are instantly able to have some form of opinion, however unqualified. that may be, to give them instant feedback that could scar them for years in the form of a comment on a local business review site, to find them on social media and give them a hard time. You know, I'd say I have a lot of sympathy for vets growing up in that backdrop. And I think that's why we have attrition levels that we do, because it's a very, very hard thing to learn your craft. But we come back to this word, the buzzword of the moment is really resilience. And I've never liked buzzwords. And I think the problem with resilience is it only tells half of the story, or maybe not even as much as half, because it's one thing to be able to take a hit and then to get back up. It's one thing to eat dirt, think it tastes bad, spit it out, and then go back for another shovel full. But that resilience brings you back to the shape, the form in which you started as a definition. It's the bounce back ability. But you're not growing if you're just ending up exactly the same place as you started. What you then need to do is learn the skill of tenacity. And that's just the critical thinking to go, your resilience says, well, that blew chunks, but I'm going to try again. Tenacity is, that blew chunks, I'm going to try again, and how can I do it differently so I don't get punched in the face this time, so I don't get a shovel full of dirt. How can I graduate to the next thing that tastes a little bit better, or I don't fall off the horse again? That's actually tenacity. And I think,
yeah, having this ability to fail forward, I think I heard someone describe
it's
it
a
that
nice
way.
That's a very nice way of putting it, actually. And you know, that's one of the things that scares me the most for my daughter, who's six, is that, you know, you as a parent, you want the best for your child. As a leader, same thing. There's so many parallels between being a vet and being a parent, and being a leader and being a parent. And I want the best for my daughter. I want the best for the people that work with me. And I want to leave a positive impact on both. And my daughter said to me the other day, we were in the swimming pool, I think, and she swims great she swims like a dolphin, really, for such a young age. And I said something, and she said, I don't want to do that because I might fail. And I thought, uh-oh, wait, no, where did that come from? We had a chat about it. And I was just happy to, just to explain to her exactly how many times her daddy tries and fails something every single day. You have to just become comfortable with failure as part of growth, part of learning, and ultimately part of success, because it is. There's absolutely, there's no growth without two things, failure and feedback. And you need, some of us don't take feedback from the world great, and so that's why mentors are useful. But failure and feedback are undoubtedly the breakfast of champs, and what are going to make you an excellent practitioner, or whatever branch you decide to go into, right? Like, it doesn't have to be general practice. It's just going to make you an excellent practitioner if you're willing to embrace failure and feedback.
Yeah, I feel like that's not even just veterinary. It's just within veterinary or just outside of veterinary. Like, that is what you need.
It's life.
To kind of be to move forward in life.
Yep.
So I feel like that definitely takes us through, like, what is happening with the veterinary students in right now, and then the recent grads, and then those who have been in practice for a couple of years, and now they're not in practice anymore. So I kind of want to turn it on its head a little bit and look at, what about the pre-vet students who are now, they're watching all of this happen. Maybe, because honestly, it wasn't right when I was in my pre-vet stage is when Instagram for veterinary was really starting to take off. I didn't have any idea of what vet school life looked like until I got to vet school and I realized, oh, there's other people starting to do this kind of look at my life kind of deal. But now I feel like at this stage, now four or five years later, you have the pre-vet students who are following on Instagram, on Facebook, all of these veterinary students and veterinarians, and they're starting to see all of the scary things that we're facing. And so is that causing a disparity between their expectations of what they think school is going to look like and what practice is going to look like and what it actually look like? So, like, are we scaring them off? Are we providing the wrong opinions? I don't know what it looks like for
them. Ooh, I could drop some bombs here. So So first thing, I don't think we're scaring students off. I think quite the opposite. I think there is still a large oversupply into the market and for entrance into, you know, animal care is still a very attractive place to go as a career when you consider it separate to the financial elements of getting your degree. I actually think and this was part of what that rant I went on in that little Instagram post was, you know, we all have responsibility. I'm actually not interested in finger pointing or blaming any one person. We all work at different parts of this value chain where we are able to provide veterinarians to do all the super important things that we do, you know, food supply, you know, drug and medicines development. Small animal veterinarians, it is no small deal now. If you ever feel bad about being a vet or what you're doing, just remember this. In this age where we are supposedly, you know, living on top of each other in cities, you know, the migration patterns say that, we're living in closer physical proximity. We're actually getting further apart in social proximity because we're stuck in our phones. Because generationally, we haven't really taught in a generation how to experience emotions very well and to handle emotions, because communication skills seem to be going in reverse. You know, if you want to manage millennials, face-to-face communication is one of the more challenging ways that millennials receive their communication and feedback. If you have a conversation, you almost, you know, you find yourself having to use emojis left, right, and center just to make who's on the receiving end feel, understand what the intent or the motive was. And if you don't, then you could expect, not infrequently, a little email back going, saying, hey, I don't think I like the tone of that. You know, and as a boss, you want to say, well, yeah, great, suck it up. But as a, you know, as somebody who's interested in communication, then you have to say, well, okay, well, that tone wasn't intended, but I also don't want to spend another 5 emails explaining that. So an emoticon's quite a handy thing. Whereas that conversation, you know, I'm hearing conversations happening between you know, people in the workplace now, and this is not just in veterinary medicine, and bosses, and you think, that's not a conversation that anyone would have dared have in the past, because you'd have gotten fired for it, or you'd have really gotten in hot water. But it's a common sort of thing. So I think as we go through, if we look through the supply chain of veterinary medicine, I think the universities or veterinary medicine has been sold as this sort of heriot-esque, wonderful career where it's all fluffy and nice and saving lives. And you make lots of money, right? And your laugh tells its own story, right? And it's not sold by vet schools as this. It's sold by primetime TV shows, whether it's Bondi Vet or Dr. Paul or any one of a number of veterinary shows that's out there. You know, you're seeing the Instagram selfie-filtered best version of veterinary medicine where everything's roses. And actually, in actual fact, when these pre-vet students are looking at, and I think this is a really important point for all of us to bear in mind, when they're looking at our Instagram feeds and they're seeing some of these big names in veterinary medicine who are just pumping out perma-positive stuff, it's fake. It's false. Because nobody's life is that good. Life, it's not about the good. It's about the journey. It's about the experience. And that means it's also about the tough parts as well. You know, if life were just one constant uphill of great and wonderful, that would in some ways start to get a little dull. It would become normal and the wonderful wouldn't seem so wonderful anymore. It's sort of the way our minds work. But life isn't. Life is a contact sport. And I think all of us who are broadcasting our thoughts and our opinions have to bear in mind that there is a generation coming along that needs to see some reality of what they're getting into. That actually, this is a profession where the cognitive load is high, the work stress is high. It can be hugely rewarding. Like, I love the cognitive load. I love the work stress. The learning curve is amazing. All of those things are wonderful. But you have to be the right sort of person to deal with that. And so we have to broadcast an image that is representative of what's on the other side, because it's not James Herriot anymore. You know, and what we really have to talk about a lot more is, and you touched on already, that clients, your success in veterinary medicine, and I would go so far as to say your success in life, comes down to whether or not you're going to be able to connect and communicate clearly with the people who pay the bills, be they farmers or be they buyers for pharma companies or the pet owners or government or whoever. There's going to be somebody pays your wage, and that person you're going to have to communicate with in order to get to do the bit that you're actually trained to do, which is the medicine or the science. And forget that at your peril. And that's, some of that is the message we've got to put out there, that, you know, we're bringing in extremely talented, smart, far smarter people than me into the profession. And we're not setting them up with a realistic expectation of it's just all going to be academia, because it's not. And there's a saying, I heard this saying the other day, which is an old saying, so this is older than me, but it's the A students are going to go into academia, the B students are going to go in practice, and the C students are going to be everyone's boss. And there's a reason for that, and that's the C students could focus on people. And there's, you know, your success, and that's a nice colourful way of saying, really, that success is far better correlated with emotional intelligence and communication skills than it is with your IQ. And so if you come in veterinary medicine as a pre-vet student thinking, well, I've got a big brain here, so I'm going to be okay, I think you find a lot of the people who have the big brains are the ones who wind up struggling, because it's, you're going to do the hard yards. It's, you know, the great news there is that if you have a big brain, then you will be perfectly capable of learning emotional intelligence skills as well, because that is a malleable thing. Like, I'm never going to change somebody's IQ, but I could help them with their EQ. I could help them with the turn of phrase at the right time, with the management of an emotional state that comes over them that might have a negative impact on their outcome. I can help them with that. And that should be a very uplifting thing to think. But it's only going to work if we start teaching those core skills at university, because otherwise I would feel very bad if I were at university and I were running a course and I were going to take $150,000 to $250,000 off of a student to put them into the world unprepared in a general practice setting for the things they're going to see. And I will put it out there to deans and course organisers that that's exactly what's happening. Because how much behavioural training do they get in pets? How much dental training do they get in pets? How much nutrition training do they get in pets? How much emotional intelligence and communication training do they get with people? And the answer is a pittance, an absolute pittance in every class around the world. It's not enough. Yet we've got students standing over spinal surgeries and orthopaedic surgeries that decreasingly they're going to get to do, because in the corporate world, the specialists are going to get to do all of those things and the generalists are just going to refer.
So the gap is going to get bigger and bigger.
I think so. And I feel bad. I feel bad for a student that's going to go study and accumulate $250,000 worth of debt who hasn't worked out how they're going to pay that back. That is not a student that's been well advised. I would say that's a student that's been let down by a lot of different people or has been very blind to the realities, because there's, you know, it's possible to pay that back, but you're going to need a plan. And, you know, and the future may not look like what you want it to look like. So if you're going to blow up and spin out and decide to leave the profession, what's next? You know, after $250,000's worth of debt, that's, you know, what are you going to retrain again and build up another, you know, $500,000 of debt now? You know, that looks like a hard road to me. So I think we need to be very, very honest about what this profession is, what it's moving to, and we need to be looking at what we're teaching the kids in university, and then we need to be way better at mentoring them when they come out of the other side, because we cannot continue to this meat grinder of poor leadership meets millennial generation and have that conflict happening that's causing people to leave the profession within 5 years. And we know that, you know, within 3 to 5 years, over 50% of graduates are saying that the profession has not met their expectation and they're not happy. And that is a very damaging thing. We actually don't need more vet schools, as some people are saying. I read in the Vet Times over here in the UK, as one of the journals, and the equine society president over here was saying, was basically saying we need two more vet schools urgently. And I think, no, we don't. All that's going to do is throw more broken people or more people into a broken system. What we need is to fix the system and to work on our leadership. And that means, you know, build better leaders, build better mentoring systems, and retain the talent we have. Because it is ethically unsound to just throw more people at that. Like, the answer isn't just to build more schools.
So looking at that then, because obviously, like, we talk about, oh, you need more mentorship, you need more people skills, but how do you get that during your time at vet school or before vet school? Because it's a limited amount of time. So I guess, like, if you were to go into a vet school, not build a new one, maybe build a new one, what would be your framework for providing that in our last couple minutes that we have?
Well, you know, human communication is a contact sport. I think you've got to pass your exams, but I would say there is a couple of things you could do. One, you do not have to get 90%, and you should stop beating yourself up. Unless you want to be an academic, unless you're competing for that prize, who cares if you get 90% or 51%? The answer is nobody. The answer is absolutely nobody. And what we know is that if you focus purely on the scientific, it's not preparing you for what you need out in vet school. It's just preparing you for exams. And so you have that moment of, you know, oh great, I got an A. Well, bully for you. If you're going to have a miserable career and 3 years later you want to stop doing it, does that really count? So why not divert a portion of your time to upskilling yourself in the subjects of communication, emotional intelligence, negotiation? You know, this was one of the reasons I started the VetX program, was to be able to teach these things. And we, you know, for the most part, we have younger doctors who are post-graduation, but increasingly we have students coming and saying, can this be done alongside university? And I say to them, look, I have no desire to send you spinning off over the edge. The answer is yes, but only if you're willing to substitute some of the things you currently spend your time on. So, you know, drop your score 5 or 10%. Does that gain you 2 hours a month to be able to interact with a community that's focused on positive encouragement and emotional development? Does that give you an hour to be able to do a module and training on, you know, from world leaders in emotional intelligence and exam room skills and time management? Would that help you? Like, taking a class in time management, that, you know, not watching, not binging on a Netflix series can bring you 2 hours of every day back into your life. You know, people are forever asking me, how do you do so many things in your life? I said, well, I switched off a TV in 2009 when I left the UK, and I've never switched it back on. That got me 2 hours of every day of my life back. You know, that's an incredible amount of time. You know, that's over 500 hours a year, which is getting on for an extra month in a year. There is ample time in everybody's life if we're willing to focus on things that really matter. And what really matters is happiness. What really matters is your long-term connection and joy in your life. What really matters are friendships, relationships with clients, with your boss, with your peers, with your family, with your friends. What really doesn't matter is whether you got 90% or 70% at vet school, unless you want to be the next dean of the vet school. And if you do, then let's keep this conversation going, so maybe we can talk about how you can build a system that delivers what the vets of tomorrow are going to require. Focus on communication skills. You know, for anyone interested, then, yeah, I've books. I'm surrounded by books just now, you know, and I constantly, you know, I haven't stopped. I read way more now than I ever did at university, because I feel a responsibility to try and teach to others what I've learned over my 20 years in a much shorter space of time. That's why I wrote So You're a Vet Now What. That's why I do the VetX Thrive project. And that's why I'll continue to try and sprinkle some goodness and some positivity into this industry, because it's been good to me. And it can be, you know, there's no question about it. Veterinary medicine is a tough career, but there's also no question in my brain. Like, I believe it's the best job in the world, and it can continue to be that. But we've got to focus on the soft skills and get that foundation in place, because you have got a lifetime to learn the clinical stuff. Be in no rush, young Padawan. You will get there.
I think that's something that I feel like no matter how many times someone tells me it, you need to be told that over and over and over again. Because even just like the other day, I was just stressing about grades and like trying to study as hard as I can to do well in this grade. Because even though I did just fine on a midterm, I was like, but the final, even it's like 4 weeks away. And like, honestly, like when you talk about don't be afraid to like drop your score a little bit. I like as soon as you said that, I was like, going into cardiac arrest.
Your adrenal glands squeezed and your heart rate went crazy.
I think you'll be hard pressed to find people.
I know.
Yeah, I think it's almost a little harder for students coming from the U.S. Maybe it's not, and it's just my own perception and my own bias. But coming from the U.S., where a 96 or a 95 and above, that's the okay safe grade. Anything below a 75 is almost considered a fail. Actually, no, I think 65 is a fail. So coming here and suddenly getting like, I got a 65 on you. Everyone's like, yay, 65. And I'm like, I'm going to go throw up in the corner because I need to end at life right now. But just getting it through my head and understanding that. But you almost sounded like a little bit of like a social IQ version of Gary Vaynerchuk when you're talking about your time management. And that's really hard, but it's so, so true. And like people do ask me, they're like, how are you involved in 500 different things? And I'm like, one, that's just how I operate. I don't know why. But it's just like I have so many different interests and like so many different things that I want to do that it's like, all right, in order to get here and enjoy what I'm doing, I got to cut out the hours over there. But it's so hard.
Yeah, it is hard, and it takes some discipline. But it is what it is. The, you know, people are always saying, you know, what's the formula for success? And you know, you can lay it out, and that's not what brings success. What brings success is someone being disciplined enough to follow that formula. You may be one of these, and you may have listeners who are one of these unicorn types of people who can get that A all the way through, be emotionally together, and just make it look easy. But that's not most of us, and nobody should set their self-esteem on the basis of somebody else's performance or somebody else's, you know, that's what's going on there. When you look at, you know, oh my God, I got, you know, 61 instead of 95. Did you pass? Yep. Does that mean you go to the next level of the course? Yep. Well done you. Do you want to be an academic so that mattered? Nope. Okay. So who cares? Let's go to the pub, move on, forget it. But it's when your self-esteem is built around this principle of feeling significant because you got that high exam score, that certainty that brings you, that's when you've got a problem. Because life, I'll guarantee you, you're not going to get 95s across the board in life. Just not going to happen. And so you have to look for other ways to define yourself and other ways to build your self-esteem and other ways to define what success actually looks like. And that's going to be different for every individual. But, you know, my I was just saying, and actually my whole circle of friends was this way inclined, but, you know, we got 51%. We were a little shitty because that was 1% too much work. And of course, that's too close to the wind. I don't recommend any of you do that. That was my recklessness, which did create me some opportunities for extra learning in the form of pass-fail orals in my second and fourth years. But I passed them. But that stress, you know, is probably something that would have been avoidable by doing just 5% more work than I had done in the first instance. But that was the way my brain worked. But I tell you what, I've had a happier career because, you know, if you're able to just let go of failure, yeah, you know, see it for something else. It's not the end. It doesn't define you. It's a step along the way. It's a scar. It's not an amputation. It's not a this is a game over moment, unless you define it as such. and there's always learning. You know, really, I have this wonderful book, which I actually bought my daughter. I've got it right here. And it's the book is called What to Do with the Problem. And it's a book written, I think it's an American book actually, by Kobe Yamada and illustrated by Mae Besom. And there's a series of books, and they're really lovely, poignant things. But they're not just children's books at all. They're written for kids, but they're not. But the takeaway from What to Do with the Problem is you look inside it, you face up to it, you look inside it for the opportunity. And that's what failure is. It's the first attempt in learning. And once you can get over that problem, you can learn from it, then you can move forward. When you get stuck on giving it meaning that doesn't exist in storytelling, that's really when you're in trouble. So look for the opportunity. Treat it as the first attempt in learning, or the second, or the sixth, or the seventh, or the tenth, and keep going, and you will succeed. So there you go.
Well, I think that is a perfect place to end it. And I feel like, honestly, I could be like, but what about this and this question and that question? But we don't have that kind of time today.
if you receive a good response, I will always be happy to come back on. So
sounds good. All right, guys. I guess we'll leave it right there. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today and just kind of going through like this Friday night rant. I feel like maybe you should do more of those a little more often because people certainly seem to enjoy it. But is there, I'll leave the floors open to you once more. What do people have to look forward to in the near future for Dr. Dave?
Well, so we are pushing on hard with the VetX Thrive class, which is a community, really not a class. So, you know, anybody out there interested in learning how to build their non-clinical skills, go check it out on drdavenickel.com/ VetX Thrive, or maybe it's just VetX at the minute. I'll send you a link for that because that's terrible marketing on my part, really, isn't it? The book sales, the Sawyer Vet and Iwot book, continues to fly off our shelves and receive really lovely feedback, which is just great, just to know it's doing some good out there. And people are forever sending me stories of how the book or the Blunt Dissection podcast has impacted them positively. And it's really just affirms to me that the work I'm doing is helping people. So no, I'm just very grateful that anybody takes any time in their day to listen to anything I'm saying. So thank you for having me on, and thank you to everybody who listens or buys a book or joins a class. I hope we're doing good for you.
No, it's been a blast to have you on, and certainly we'll hopefully have you on again. But yeah, guys, go and check out, he has a podcast as well. Actually, no, two podcasts, right?
Blunt Dissection and Freewheeling.
Yes, go, and you can find them on almost every single major podcasting platform. So go listen to this one, and then go listen to those ones, and you'll just kind of like be binge listening to podcasts, I'm sure. But yeah, I think with that, time is starting to really run short here. So I will leave you guys with the wonderful thoughts to kind of mull over from Dr. Dave. And until next time, guys, see ya.
Hey, y'all, and thanks for joining me for another episode of That Vet Life. If you want to learn more, you can find me on Instagram and Facebook at That Vet Life. To hear more episodes, you can find That Vet Life on any major podcasting platform. And if you're on iTunes, go and give me a rating and leave a comment. I love hearing from you guys. To check out Dr. Dave, you can find him on Facebook and Instagram at Dr. Dave Nickel. And if you want to find his website, you can find him at drdavenickel.com. There you can find all of his books, podcasts, and links to VetX. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode, and until next time, see ya!